Blog Talk Radio. Hello, everyone, and welcome once again to Madame Perry Salon, or as I call it, the podcast that loves you, the podcast where fascinating people meet. And I am so grateful to have all the guests that I have. You know, there was something on it's Podbean, another podcast app. And on Twitter, they ask a lot of questions of podcasters. And one of the questions was this week, who is your dream guest for your podcast? Who is your dream guest? And I don't always answer these, but this time I had to. I said, every guest I have is a dream guest because I'm grateful that, one, they accepted the invitation, or sometimes maybe their publicists reach out asking if they ask to have them on the show, and sometimes the guests themselves will ask. And sometimes their fans will ask, and that's great. All of it's great. I had a couple of reviews I read of the podcast that said it doesn't matter if the guest is a famous person or someone you've never heard of, if it's if they write or act or work in a field or genre that you like or something that you don't know of that you've never heard of before, that it's always interesting. The guest is always interesting. And I was so grateful for that because I value every listener and every guest. So I said, yeah, every guest is a dream guest. And that, of course, especially includes tonight's guest. He's been on here, I think, twice before. He has an incredible career. A couple of careers, actually, and as a musician, for one, when I say musician, I'm talking legit, serious, on the road, popular musician, and as a writer, as screenwriter, this man does a lot. So I'm going to go ahead and bring him in right now because I am thrilled and delighted to have him all the way from the UK, where he lives, and that is the one and only Graham Sclater. Graham, welcome.
Hi, Jennifer. Nice to be with you, and very nice things you said there. Wonderful.
Oh, well, yeah, every guest is a dream guest for me. So, I mean, there's more people I'd like to have, but a lot of the people I have had on, I can't wait to have them back, like you. So, in fact, I think I may have had one of your friends or musical contemporaries on not long ago, Chris White.
You did, from Liverpool, Manchester, yeah.
Oh, is he? Okay, cool.
Well, Joe Symes, yeah?
Well, Joe Symes, yeah, definitely. But I was thinking, also Chris White, one of the original members of the Zombies.
That's right, yeah.
And so, yeah, oh my gosh, yeah, Joe Symes and the drummer for Joe Symes, the lovely kind, Colin White, two of my favorite guys.
That's it, yeah, Colin, yeah.
We're on. Graham, you know, there's so much you've got, so much I want to cover about you and your career as a musician, as a writer, and as always, I don't know where to start. There's so much. It's like a banquet where you don't know where to start. You know, well, the dessert looks so good. Do you want to just skip everything and go there, or what?
Let's start to eat, Jennifer. Let's do it.
Okay. All right. You have a new book out this year, and it is your. Am I right that it's your ninth?
It's my ninth novel, but my tenth book. I did write what I call a write-on. And it was a book for authors. When I speak on the ships, a lot of people come to the talks and they say, look, we don't know where to start. So they said, why don't you write a book? As well as doing your talks, why don't you write a book that we can buy? Because we don't remember everything you've said. So I came up with the title Write On, W-R-I-T-E, and it sells really well. So I've actually written 10 books, but 9 novels, yeah.
All right. And we'll get to also to you teaching about writing class, but your 9th novel is called Born to Run, and congratulations.
Uh-huh.
And give us, for people who are new to the books and new to you, give us an idea what they can expect in Born to Run.
Well, Born to Run, like most of my others, is a thriller, and it follows on from 2 books earlier. I wrote a novel about 4 years ago called Love Shack, which was set in the red light district of Amsterdam, and I finished it with a fire on New Year's Eve. It's set in the year 1999-2000, and there was a fire at the Love Shack, which was a bar and a brothel, and people interviewed me, and people that read it said, well, you can't leave it there. You've got to tell us what happened. So I wrote another novel, Cowboys and Angels, and then I felt that I could do a follow-up. So I wrote the follow-up, which is I Will Survive. And when I finished that and people read it, they said, look, you can't leave it like that. What happened? So we had the lockdown, so I decided only about 12, 18 months ago, I found it very hard for the first year with the lockdowns. I couldn't really get motivated because I didn't know when it was going to end or if it was ever going to end the way it was going. So I didn't really want to spend time writing, not knowing whether I would A, ever cruise again or the books would ever come out, you know. So about 18 months ago, I decided to write the third in the series, and they are all standalone novels, but I wrote the third one, and I've now got a resolution to my characters and the situations. And the basic setup of it is you've got one female lady called Zita, who was a member of the Israeli Mossad, but she dropped out and bought a houseboat in Amsterdam called the Madonna, and she lived on there really undercover, but working for an Amsterdam-y gangster. But she was very low-key, and she thought that she was invisible. A gentleman from London who was an alcoholic and drug addict called Liam Riley was forced to leave England, and he ended up in Amsterdam. And a few months after going there and opening the Love Shack, he met Zita. So the 3 books really follow their situation right through to the end. But in this, in Born to Run, they actually have to come back to London because the Mossad actually have had enough of them using, or Zita using their history and their links and everything else. So at the beginning of the novel, they are attempted to be assassinated by a sniper, but he fails. And so the only thing they can do is go to London. So the book really is Zita and Liam leaving Amsterdam, coming to London, sorting out all the problems that have hung around them for the last 2 books, and then eventually going back to Amsterdam. It's a thriller. It's quite violent in places because that sort of life, gangsters, drug addicts, drug dealers, prostitutes and pimps, is a dirty underworld, you know. It's a very dirty underbelly. So you've got to put it in the book. You can't really be too violent, but again, you've got to put it in what works within the story.
Mm-hmm. What, and I have to say too, yeah, it is real, it is gritty, it is raw. And the first one I read was the middle of that trio or trilogy called I Will Survive. And
Yep.
If someone were to ask me about it, because yes, it is a thriller, and that is no joke, folks. That is not just a category to put it into. When I say thriller and Graham Slater, I mean, it comes out, it opens like the busted Bronco ride at a rodeo.
Yeah,
you ever
been to
a rodeo?
I mean,
on TV?
I read a book at least 1 book a month. I do a book review show, a 10-minute review of a book every month, and I've read a lot of thrillers, and I did say last month when I read, it wasn't really a thriller because it would have worked on television as a slow burner, but for a reader, there was nothing thrilling in it except the last few pages, And people have said that to me. Your books are real thrillers, whereas a lot of books, a lot of authors, although they sell millions of books, they are not thrillers. You could do it in probably in 20 pages. You could write the whole thing in 20 pages, but they often extend them to 300 or 400, you know. But I like to read. I love to read, and I will read anyone's work. But when you see it, you know, million seller, best thriller I've ever read, I don't think it's strictly true.
That's so true. Right. So when people even, like, give me an example.
Well, Lee Child, I mean, he's finished from writing. The last book he wrote with his brother. But a friend of mine who used to do the typesetting for Lee Child, I spoke to him last week. He just finished Born to Run, and he said, that worked. That was really good. And I said, but you get a lot of authors, and they've got recommendations from Lee Child and other top authors, and he sniggered, you know. And I said, what's wrong? He said, well, if you look at it, a lot of those people that have said it's really good and recommend it are also with the same publisher.
Oh. Okay. And as you are a professional publicist,
you know, you can understand that.
Yeah, because you know the publicity business, and you know that I'm a publicist, and you're a publicist, so we all know what that implies. And what it actually means. Yeah. Well, then that is a legit review. You know, it seriously is.
Well, then great. I mean, I get great reviews, and I'm very proud of it and pleased with it. I've only ever had one bad one, and that was someone who said, that's my first novel, Ticket to Ride, and he said, oh, the characters weren't developed. Well, quite a few of them died before the end, so, you know, it's quite difficult developing characters that I knew as a writer that they were going to die anyway. So, you don't spend a lot of time on doing that, but that's the only real... a bad review, if you like, that I've had. But I did put it in the book with the other reviews. I didn't want to leave it out.
Oh, very good. Well, you know, Graham, I'm going to talk about in just a minute about your the courses, the writing classes that you give, but I can see why they're so popular. So as I was saying, you know, if you watch a rodeo, if you've ever been to one or watched it on TV, you know, as soon as that door opens and the bucking bronco comes out, it's on, it's high,
The other thing, you know, Jennifer, sorry to interrupt because there is a slight delay, which is a little bit difficult at times, but when you watch the rodeo, actually the horse is already primed up with a guy on it. So I would sort of compare that to the title and cover of the book, because before they hit that ring and get out there, I assume you call it a ring, before they get into the circuit, that horse is already angry and the rider's holding on for dear life before it actually... They drop the gate, isn't it? So it's all building up before that.
Oh, yeah, you're exactly right, yeah. So, in other words, when you open a Graham Slater book, you better buckle in. So you're not going to put the book down and forget to get it again. You're going to go, wait, I got to hurry up and finish this so I can get back to the book. Okay, so... the characters, I got to tell you, I was so grateful for Born to Run because at the end of I Will Survive with the assassination Zeta gets the message and she knows what it means. She knows it's what she's done. She knows why. And this is what she knows this is her. This has been her life. And she knows what she's done to cause that she would get assassinated or eliminate, you know, as an asset. It's done. Let's just say it's over. And she accepts it, and she just takes that moment for that last dance and hug with Liam, and then thinking, oh, gosh, I love this character. I love her so much. I don't want this to be over. And then it's like you heard our prayers from all over the world, Graham. And then, okay, or maybe you already had it planned before the end of that book. But
no, I didn't.
Still,
I didn't have it planned at all. I didn't know where it was going to go, and it was only, as I say, after the lockdown that I did an interview. I think it was November of not last year, the year before, just before Christmas it was December, and the gentleman had read I Will Survive, and he actually phoned me up. He said, look, I've got an interview on the station today. It was the BBC in Bristol, actually. And he said, I'm going to do an interview, but are you going to write another one? And I said, well, no. He said, you've got to. So we did the interview, and at the end of the interview, I then said, or he asked me, are you writing a follow-up? And I said, yes, I am. And that then got me into it. And I did it. It's the quickest book I wrote, actually, Born to Run.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but I knew the characters well already, you see, which is always a help, isn't it?
Yeah, yes, it is. And I always keep thinking, where? None of us who read you ever know where it's going next. We just know we got to hang on.
No.
White knuckled, maybe, you know, or hanging on to that little hook at the top of the car above the window on the passenger side where you hang on if the driver's going too fast. But still, we're there to hang on.
Right. Yeah. No, that's wonderful. But that's what I try to do. I don't waste. I mean, people. I talk to a lot of writers, and they say, "Oh, I've written 120,000 words, and I want to do 130." And I say, "Why?" They said, well, the more words you get, the better it is. And I said, no, if you look at a lot of the James Bond original novels, they're incredibly short, pages in and chapters, just for the sake of it, just to say I've written X number of words.
Exactly. It's like Ian Fleming or Edgar Allan Poe, you know, they run the gamut of styles, but still, yeah, it's always, always quality over quantity.
Exactly, but a lot of people now, my first novel, Ticket to Ride, I did, every day I wrote, I used to keep a record of how many words I'd written that session, and it wasn't to sort of build up the numbers, it was just to see the best time of day for me to work, and which parts of the book were harder to write, so I might only write 1,000 words, but it could take me 6 hours, you know, whereas another time you could do 2,000, and you'd do that in 2 or 3 hours. And so it depends on the time of day, the mood. There is a good time. We've all got good times and good days and good weather to work in. And once you know what that is, then writing can be a lot easier because there's no point sitting there, I don't know what to do. I've got writer's block, which I honestly don't believe exists. What it means is you haven't researched your characters and you're not sure what your story is about. But once you know and you find that, in a winter evenings for me are brilliant because I don't look at the clock. I have my dinner at say 5, 6 in the evening, and then I'll sit in my study until I've really gone as far as I can. And sometimes it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and I don't even know it's that time, you know.
Whoa! I think that's called, you know, you're in the game right there. You are totally into the world and the story.
Exactly.
And I think that's fascinating.
Yeah.
I've heard people talk about, oh, I wrote this many words. How many words did you write today? Blah, blah, blah. Or set some kind of a goal for this many words. And I like your philosophy so much better. It makes so much more sense. You said you counted to see what was a better time of day to write. Or when was a better time,
right.
A better circumstance.
And I mean, my kids are grown up, luckily, but... And it was a great journey with them. But, you know, I can do it whenever I want. But there are certain times a day that I can't really fire on all cylinders. So what I tend to do then, if I have got the book up, I would just flick through it. Because when I write, I actually type messages to myself within the words. So if I write something and I think it's poor or rubbish, I'll actually type that in capitals. This is rubbish, need to sort this out, and I'll carry on. And other times, if I'm not really in full flow, I'll just spin the pages and just start working on certain words. I mean, if I need a certain word and it's not right, I will put a slash, and then I'll write any other word I can think of, and then highlight it in a colour, and then when I've got that time, when I think I've got a couple of hours, let's have a look and tidy up some of these chapters. So I will work on those little bits, and maybe come up with a totally different word and get rid of all the others.
Ah, okay. That's That makes sense and obviously works. Well, here's another aspect to your writing. It's another part, a very important part of your life. You worked and lived, you were a working musician, not only in England, but in Hamburg, Germany, and toured for much of the 60s. You played the Hammond organ, oh my gosh, and worked even not only in your band, but also as a session guy with people like Hendrix, Elton John, Ritchie Blackmore, James Taylor, Christine Perfect. That's quite a career.
Well, it is, and people say that to me now, as you do. But, of course, back then, we were all musicians. We were all doing what we wanted to do. Some of us loved it. Some found it a way of not doing what I would call, or some would call, a proper job. But if you're creative, there is a real buzz when you get on stage, whether it's for a dozen people or 10, 20,000. You get the same buzz because people have come to see you. If they haven't come to see you because you're the support band, then you don't get that buzz. It's, God, let's get off quick, you know. But assuming they've paid to come and see you, then you've got a converted audience there. And that buzz is wonderful. And, the problem is, though, you know, Jennifer, is when you come off stage, you know, you come off at 10, 11 or whatever, your adrenaline is really pumping. And that is why, unfortunately, so many musicians fall into the trap of heavy, hard drugs, partying too much and drinking too much, because it's a natural thing to do. You come off and you're buzzing, you know, you just, what am I going to do next? I've only done 2 hours. What am I going to do the rest of the night or the morning, whatever time you've finished? And you do need that release. Now, if you're doing a tour, as I did with Fats Domino, for 6 weeks with only one night off,
jeez,
that's a long time to get hooked into all those things, you know?
Whoa. Yeah, you're right. That's another thing different from a regular or alleged proper job is that you can't just start your work time off, make a few phone calls to my friends, maybe read the paper, have some coffee. No, when it's start time, you're off. You are there.
Well, that's right. And, of course, it starts
110%.
But it starts earlier than that because you're driven or flown to the next town or city, and you've taken to your hotel and you're booked in by the tour manager. Then you're taken to the venue with a stadium or whatever, and you do a sound check. Well, that could be sort of early afternoon, but you're not on stage until 9 o'clock in the evening. Now, some of the venues that we did across Europe were ice rinks, and they were outside of the city, and the tour bus wouldn't take us back to the hotel, because if we'd have gone back to the hotel, we'd have fallen asleep, maybe missed the gig, and as the poor guitarist did at the end of the Fats tour, one from the end, he died from a heroin overdose in Amsterdam, and that was literally the penultimate gig that we were going to do. And so by, you know, getting into the venue and hanging around, you start drinking then, you drink too many coffees, you get bored, you maybe, you know, get into a few drugs or whatever, and then you've got that long period before you go on stage, so you're up having the sound check, you're happy. Then you've got hours of doing nothing. Now, sometimes you can sit down and write songs, or, you know, you meet up with a couple of people and you sit in a room and have a chat or do whatever. But it's that time in between. So you're up, you're down, then you're on stage, and then you come off again. And that is the problem. And, of course, you've got to be up reasonably early the next day to go on to the next venue, which could be several hundred miles away.
Wow. That's a rough life.
Well, it is. I mean, when you're playing, that's the best time. You know, a couple of hours, it's fantastic. But the other 22 hours in the day really is incredibly boring. And most musicians will tell you that, whether they're the Stones or anyone else. You know, they still have periods of time. I mean, people like the Stones have they have their own room backstage, you know, with equipment and TV, drinks, food, whatever. So they are in a little cocoon then, and then they go on stage. So that is a little bit easier. But back in the 60s and 70s, we didn't have any of that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. It was very different, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So tell us then, I mean, obviously, since you have traveled, and one thing that, you know, people, well, I know here in the United States, when we read or learn about friends who live in England, realize that you're so close, you know, because of your proximity to Europe, you know, people get to travel more, travel to, you know, Germany or France or somewhere. Obviously, your travels and your career in the music business, which was a serious career, has to have a lot of effect on giving you the authenticity or the agency to write so colorfully and brilliantly and truthfully about the things that you see.
The things that you see
in your books.
Well, that's right. And I say to writers, and you talked about the cruises, I say, you know, write about what you know, or if you don't know everything, then you've got to research. So in I Will Survive, if you remember, it was in Estonia, which is in Tallinn, Estonia. They were in Hamburg. They were in Berlin. They were in the Canary Islands. They were in all these different places. Well, those are places that I've been, and I know them. And so, therefore, when I write, I basically rough out where it's going to be or what it's going to be, and then I research. Or if I'm on a cruise, then I'll say, right, Estonia is a great place, Tallinn, a beautiful medieval city. Then that will be a location for one of the events within the book, which is what I did, of course. But you've got to know it. You've got to see it. You've got to smell it. You've got to look for the street names. You've got to look at what's there, anything that you can put in the book to make it of interest, not just fill the pages. So research and experience really is paramount, in my opinion, before you even start writing.
Yeah, it is. And that's another value. That was another value add, as I say, for me, because I had been to Amsterdam twice, and I'd been to Canary Islands once, and you took me back. You know, places that I would love to revisit and haven't had the opportunity to as of yet. You took me back into the exact places where I've been, and if I hadn't been to all of them, I'd been close enough to know, or at least see over the canal or whatever to the place you were describing, and that was just absolutely delicious in itself.
Well, I think it's very, very important. I mean, without knocking Lee Child, because he's a multi-millionaire, incredibly successful, sold more books than I probably ever will, because he's written a lot more. But in one novel I read, part of it was set in Hamburg, and I read it and I thought, he hasn't been to Hamburg, because there's nothing there that mentions or links to anything that is there. And I watched a documentary on YouTube where he was challenged by a lady in America about one of his books, and she said, you know, you've mentioned a city, Chicago, I think it was. She said, but they haven't got that there, and they haven't got this, and they haven't got that. And he stood up and he said, I'm the writer. If it's there in my mind, it's there in the book. And she said, but that's not real. He said, it doesn't matter. I'm the writer. I write what I want to write. Now, I don't believe in that. And he can say that, can't he? He can say what he likes, you know, but I wouldn't want to do that. I want the feedback, just as you have said. It's like you're there, you've been there, you know what it's like. That's what I aim for.
And so much so that when even a place I haven't been, you put me there, and I love to travel, and so you and books are a way to travel, and you really put us there, and I can picture, you know, one thing, say when you're in Amsterdam, or when I was there, and every time you stop somewhere for a cup of coffee or coffee and a waffle or something. You never get a cup of coffee or any kind of coffee drink without them giving you some little snack with it, maybe a little cookie.
That's right. That's right.
Something with it. Yeah, those things always there that I miss when I get back home. But you had me sit there with my coffee and my little treat they give you, and it's like, my God, he's like science fiction. He takes me back there, you know. And in a way, you know, when people say write what you know and learn about it, then again, of course, science fiction, yeah, there you are the writer and you do make up the world. You know, you create the world and the characters and
yeah.
the species or whatever. But you do just enough of that to give all of your readers an instant transport.
Oops. Yeah,
time
and I want to do that. I mean, I think and the sort of food that they have, the sort of restaurants, the places. I mean, the new one I've just started, that is set in England, but one of my characters has dreadlocks, and I've had to research where in the town he would go, because it's a real town, to have his dreadlocks, his straight hair turned into dreadlocks, and what it would cost. So I've had to look at that, and I've spoken to the gentleman that does it, and I'm going to go to a tattoo parlor in a couple of weeks just to chat to one of the people there, just to find out what sort of ink they use and everything else, where they get their needles and stuff like that, so that when I come to write it, it will be some real. And if I've never had a tattoo, so anyone who hasn't, they won't know the procedure. They'll guess it, but they won't know the procedure. So I want that, and it's only half a page even, you know, but I want it to be right.
Yes, yes. And that's why your readers love you so much. Tell me, though.
Well, I assume it is, yes, yes.
Yeah. So to come more about specifically your newest book, Born to Run, the two main characters, Zita and Liam. Now, Zita is has ex-Mossad. I'm in Israel. Tell us about, for people who don't know what that is, and her connection with it.
Okay. Well, the Mossad is the Israeli Secret Service Special Forces. When they have problems, they will send out one or two of their Mossad elite, and they will either assassinate someone and disappear without being found. They are recognized as being probably the best in the world, better than the SAS in the way the SAS work, better than the CIA, FBI, probably CIA actually. But they are trained thoroughly, not just in weapons and ordnance, but in languages. They learn several languages. They don't go out, they don't go to Afghanistan if they can't speak it. They won't go to, I don't know, Germany if they don't speak German fluently and have a full background. So they're able to just disappear into the world, into the masses, do what they need to do, and get out. And if there is any terrorism involved, they will go in and sort that out as well. And they're in and out in a flash, and they're incredibly well-trained. And that's why Zita was able to do what she spoke, five languages. She'd learned all sorts of MMA and stuff like that, martial arts. In the book, she just disappears, you know. She's, one minute she's there, she changes her look completely. She just does so much. She's a very, very clever young lady, and a lot of the Mossad operatives are like that. So they're very secretive. They're given different names quite often. In fact, they are given different names, and they're just set loose in the world to sort out a specific problem or problems.
And so with all of her skills and plus all of her knowledge about the specific assignments or missions that she's been on, that mm-hmm. valuable intel, how does one become like her, where she's living off by, you know, not really involved all the time? And she's
Yeah. Well, what she did in the book, I don't want to give it away. I'm not sure if you've read it yet. I did send you a copy, but she... she does a deadly deed in Switzerland, in Zurich. And while she is there to kill a banker who's been financing the Arab terrorists, she actually, he says, don't kill me. She says, okay. And he actually pays her through secret bank accounts a lot of money. She shouldn't have done that. And nobody knows that at the time. But they do find out. But many years later, so with that money, she buys the houseboat in Amsterdam and decides then to disappear. Now, in the book, they say they would have known where she's been all the time. Whether they did or not, I don't know. I think that's more of a bluff, but they said they knew where she was and they could have killed her any time, and Liam if they wished. So she was able to keep out the way for as long as they wanted her to be. So it was a very clever move on her her handlers and the main guy running it to let her stay there, thinking she's safe, until she gets the telegram, of course.
Yeah. You, it's one of those, you may be gone, but you're never forgotten.
Exactly. We know where you are. And that was, and that came to me as an afterthought, to be honest, because Born to Run, there were a lot of things in there that obviously I didn't know about her and Liam, and I had to imagine it. I'd been on a cruise, so I was able to think it through a bit, went to Amsterdam again, and then I went to London, and I just checked out the East End of London, which is where they, Liam's parents were based. And so I had to research the streets there and just make sure, and the house that Liam's wife lived in and where his father lived, because the houses, the gardens link each other. England's houses are quite strange, that, you know, houses back onto other houses linking gardens, you know. So I wanted their houses to back onto each other, and where there was a big scene, I wanted that to be near the River Thames, in an area that they could disappear. Liam and his father could disappear in an hour. That was very important to me. So I had to research that and walk those streets and just get a feel of where they would be, how they would do it. They've got to be able to do it. You can make up anything and come up with made-up streets and various transport or whatever, but it's got to work. When I write it, I want it to work. I don't want people emailing me and phoning me saying, that's terrible. That couldn't possibly have happened because that street is 3 miles away.
And I've got to admit, I'll be one of those, because people will talk about, obviously, I'm from the south of U.S. in Atlanta, Georgia, where I was born and raised. And I will notice differences and think, now, no, that is, we don't all, no, we don't do that. That's a myth. That's not constant. When in the movie, there was a TV movie, I may have mentioned this to you, about Mark David Chapman and killed John Lennon, and the way he talked on actor talked on there. Okay. And I said, I didn't know Mark David Chapman. But
no,
the rest of my family did. His dad worked with my dad sometimes. His brother was in Scouts, so my mom knew his mom, his family, and all that. So he was from my neighborhood, and the rest of my family knew him, but I didn't. But I can tell you this. Mark David Chapman grew up in Gresham Park in southeast Atlanta. If he talked as, and I forget who the actor was that played him, if he had him talking like some kind of mid-1800s, riverboat gambler. If he talked like that in area of Atlanta, no, honey, he would not have lived long enough to kill anybody. He would have been, that was a mean neighborhood. He would have been beaten up, whooped, run out of, no, he wouldn't have lived that long. did not talk like that.
No, but that to me, you see, I'm not a perfectionist, but I want to get it right as much as I can. But I would blame the film producers and the directors for that, because there is no excuse for that. I mean, I watch a lot of films on television, and we have British actors playing Americans, and the accents all over the place, and Americans playing British actors over here so they can sell it to America and vice versa. But they've got to try to get it right, because accents here around England are very, very different, and you know, you've got to get it right. So in a film like that, which was, you know, quite horrific when you think of the, you know, what happened in it, they should have got it right. And in all honesty, I don't feel there's any excuse for it.
Mm-mm. No. No, not when there's so much information available and audio. If I want to listen to something, I can always go to YouTube or somewhere and listen to someone speak in a certain area if I wanted to learn their
accent. Exactly.
And yes, and by the way, yes, I have read Born to Run. I thank you so much for sending me a copy. And I just have to be real careful how I talk to you about it because I don't want to give away.
I know.
Iota.
Did you like the resolve at the end, though?
I did. I didn't expect it the way it was.
Did you like that?
I did. Yeah. But I got to tell you, I had to wrestle with it. You know, because you get so involved in the characters by the end of three books.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Okay.
Yeah, because Liam's mother and father really weren't featured very much in the first book in Love Shack, you know, and I had to when I wrote this one, I had to research them and work out, I'll learn a lot more about them that I didn't know before. It took me a bit of time. But, yeah, they are different characters. That's why each book is a standalone novel, really. You can pick up one, any of the three, and still go back and read the earlier ones. And it still works, you know.
True. That's very true, yeah. Yeah, because before, we had an inkling of his relationship with his father and you know, he had a wife and so forth, but you would just give us like little tiny glimpses, like you were just sort of like you were
yes,
opening
yes.
the lid to a gift and then shutting it back up.
Yeah, because I didn't know what they were going to do. So,
but that was
deliberate in a way, because otherwise the book would have been much longer and it would have gone off on a tangent. And as I said earlier, I want the books to move forward at a pace, and normally the chapters are 6 pages long on average, not necessarily 6, but as near to 6 as I can get it. So if I start filling in other things, other aspects of the characters that wouldn't make any difference, then I wouldn't put it in. But I needed it for the third book, and that's why I spent quite a bit of time working out ages. I always work out ages backwards. You know, the parents' age, his grandfather, whatever. The ages have got to work when they were born. So otherwise you could have kids, and you're only 20 years old, and you could have 3 kids, you know, and to 32, which meant that his children would be older. And he had twins, of course, twin daughters, which, again, was very important to me.
Right. Another thing, too, and I think this also draws on to your some of your skills as you've written teleplays and screenplays, am I right?
Yeah, I've written 3 TV series, never been made, but I've written them, and I've had options on them. And screenplays, I've got, it's an option with an American company on my historical novel and the script I wrote from that, and I've turned that now into a 5-part series, and I'm just waiting to hear what's going to go on there. But I started out writing scripts, and that gave me a lot of insight into dialogue, because, again, dialogue, you don't want words in dialogue that mean nothing. Mm-hmm. If you listen to people on a bus or a train, they say very little, you know, about the weather, or they're going fishing, or they're just going shopping, or they got a backache or something, but they don't actually talk in detail. So when I write dialogue, it's got to make sense, and it's got to move the story on. It's no good 2 or 3 people talking about the weather and, oh, it's going to rain, or we just had a hurricane, so the windows have been blown out. You can work on that because you can get rapport with that, but especially if someone who's never been in a hurricane. But no, dialogue's very important, so writing scripts helped me a lot. And when I watch any film on television, I always have the words on the bottom, the text, because you see how little people say. And I also, while I'm watching it, I in my head write the action part, the movements, you know, the things that people are doing. He's coughing, he's scratching his head, he's kicking his heels, snapping his fingers. I write all that while I'm watching a film.
Ah, okay. Yeah. So that is why
It trains my mind, you see.
Uh-huh. And it... Okay, all right. I can see that now. You have ways. Okay, say in Love Shack. See, I'm trying not to give away Born to Run. In Love Shack, when there's the character, the wealthy, I call him mobster, gangster guy, has got this elaborate escape scheme. I mean, you talk about an exit strategy.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, and when you describe it, it's the way it was put together, where he has that secret underground place, and it's so sophisticated, and the other car waiting, and it is, it's in a way, it seems like, you know, okay, this is like definitely out of James Bond, but you write it. So to me, now I'm not a writer of fiction, but to me as a reader, it came across very cinematically. I could see it.
Yeah.
I could watch it like I was kicked back on the sofa watching it on TV. I could see it right there.
That's
but
right, Jennifer. Well, a lot of people say that because I think I started writing scripts. That's probably how I write, you see. And a lot of people say, oh, it's very visual. It's almost, it's not like a script, but it's visual. And I want people to actually see it. And I close my eyes. And when I read it, when I've written sections, I will then close my eyes or I'll half close them and I'll read it. And I'll act it out in my mind, you know, and different characters talking in a different way, because otherwise dialogue, the characters will end up all speaking in the same way. So you've got to make sure. And I have photographs on the wall of the characters to make sure that I can see what they look like. And I'll let you and your listeners into a secret. Zita is based on the South African actress Charlize Theron.
Ooh. All right.
Yeah.
Boy, we
over here, she's been in Mad Max. She's been in loads of films.
Yeah.
But she is wonderful. And, you know, her different looks that she has. So when I started writing, I think she's a great actress. And when I started writing the original Love Shack, I needed a character, so her picture was on my wall with the name Zita in under it. So I can see her movements. Or, I mean, she acts in many different ways, but you know where she is and who she is, you know?
Oh, yeah, yes. And so, yeah, definitely. And Charlize Theron, I mean, excellent, excellent call there. But, yeah, this is where, this to me, this is where one of your superpowers is so prominent. You are able to, even though we're reading the words, you make us feel, or definitely made me feel, like I'm watching it happen, not just reading.
Yeah, well, that's great. Thank you very much.
And then I get through and I close up, you know, I stop reading for the evening and I go, Graham, what kind of voodoo have you got?
Well, my wife says the same. You know, I don't swear. I don't think I even swore when I was a musician, to be honest. Maybe on a bad night when people were making mistakes or I was making mistakes, but I don't swear. So it's very difficult to type all the words. But my wife says, how can you imagine this? She said, I've been married 54 years. And she said, how on earth is your mind coming up with this? And when we talk to people when we're out and about and they've said, I've just read your book called The Violence, she said, I don't know where he gets it from. But what happens is you get taken over by the characters. The characters take over, but you need to know them well enough to allow them to do that. And that's why I always work out a backstory, and I have a photograph of who it is, so they exist in my mind.
Then I also want to make sure people know, because I know this is coming back. Yes, you do have a book called Write On. It's on creative writing. If you're an author, if you want to be an author, if you want to write even short stories and don't know what to do, you should get this book, Write On. It's like having it's like Graham is suddenly your pal, and he's right there giving you all the information and guidance that you could possibly want in a book. You can get it on his website, and it's from Tabitha Music or Tabitha Publishing. Tell us about that.
No, the best way to get it is from GrahamSlater.com. And Slater is S-C-L-A-T-E-R. GrahamSlater.com or on Amazon. They're all on Amazon as e-books and as paperbacks. But Write On was written for, I say, people on the cruise ships, because I give a look into family history, to script writing, and coming up with a novel from scratch, which I came up with sitting at a little seaside town called Brixham, which is near us. And there's photographs of the characters as well. And it shows you how it all works and how things come together. So it's a great book. I mean, when I started writing, I went to our local library, and I took out every book they had on script writing and creative writing. I was so disappointed because they all said different things. There were no two of the books actually telling you to do it the same way, and it was so different that it confused me massively. I really was confused, and I said to my wife, look, I'm going to get rid of these books. I'm going to take them back because they're all telling me to do different things, and you know, I just didn't know what to do. So, you know, I'm almost self-taught there, really, Jennifer, but now I know where I am and what I'm doing. I thought, well, Write On would help people.
Mm-hmm.
And there are lots of links in the back, you know, for publishing the ISBN numbers and how to do this, how to do that. So it's a great help. I'm not selling it as such, but it's, if you want to start writing or you're thinking about it, it's well worth having a read first. And look who the big sellers are in there. You'd be quite surprised.
And also, just for people listening to know that, I will be sharing the link to Graham Slater's website on all the social media for Madame Perry Salon, as well as on my personal social media. So if you should see it there, and if somehow you miss it, always ask me. You can always look up Graham Slater, or you can always ask me as well. I'm happy to share it. And so, yeah, so tell us then about, while we still have time, since we're talking about writing and about, I mean, I would love to take your class, and I would love, hope to do it in the next, maybe in the next year. But tell us about your courses on the cruise ships. That is fascinating to me.
Okay. Well, I talk on creative writing. I also do talks on, believe it or not, the 60s, the Beatles in Hamburg, myself in Hamburg, orchids, tulips. The Canary Islands, I do lots of talks. I go to Christie. I do what they call enrichment talks. I do those in the main theatre. But my creative writing talks are normally to maybe 20 or 30 people. And depending on the length of cruise, because I only do it on the sea days. So the last one I did, which was Christmas and New Year, I did 8 talks. And what is great is the ship stocked my books in the ship shop. So people start buying them. By the end of the cruise, they're coming up to me asking me all sorts of questions about the characters and why I did this, that, and the other. But what I try to do, they are classes, but they're very relaxed. And what I try to do is take the fear out of writing. I show people something I always start with is a timeline, which is an Excel spreadsheet, very simple to do. I show them one of mine, and I show them one of J.K. Rowling's. Now, J.K. Rowling's are all handwritten. Mine are typed on the computer because I can't read my writing. Once I go over the lines, it's a mess. But she actually, for her Harry Potter, I've got one for one of her Harry Potter novels, and it just shows how you work and not to be frightened of, you know, putting rings around things and having options and that. So I talk about timelines, which is very important. I also talk about backstory, and how people need to know their characters before they start to write their book. I talk about family history books. I talk about writing in the different genres. I also tell them that your town or city, if it's fictitious, a great way to do it is to get a free tourist map of a town and use the real streets when you start writing. And then once you've got your book well and truly on, if you want, then make it a fictitious town and change the names of the streets. But you actually can see the map. You've got the map of where you're going. I talk about whether you write in the first, second, or third person. I always write in the third. The first, I find, is quite potentially difficult. Second, very few people write in the second person. So I do that, and then I talk about the word count, as we did earlier, chapters, breaking it down, and I just work through in the course of the talk. I mean, if you're only 3 or 4, then it's quite difficult. But what happens, Jennifer, is people will then talk to me during the cruise, and I'm happy to chat. I'll talk to anyone, you know, and some people actually bring things on the ship for me to read, and it's very hard for me to comment because some of it they spend... Yeah, well, some have spent years on it, and it's really bad.
Oh.
But I can't tell them it's really bad. I just say that you need to go back and rewrite it with a certain angle, you know, rather than how you see it.
Yeah.
And biographies, I talk about that as well, and how you should work that out and only put important things in. No one wants to know what you have for your lunch, but they want to know where you had your lunch and why you had your lunch on the Eiffel Tower in Paris. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
You don't just want to say, oh, I had my lunch in the corner shop. You know, it just doesn't work. So you've got to be critical of your own work and not rely on close family to read it and give you comments that are negative.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're all going to say, I love it, even if they haven't read it, you know?
True. Or they might say, you should change this, and they could be totally wrong. What they think should change would be what the readers love.
That's exactly. Don't like that name. Why? Well, I just don't like it. Well, it works for me. I mean, because I again, another one I talk about is the names of the characters. I take ages working out names and not having two names that are similar because readers will get confused. Not putting too much description in of the character every time a new one appears, or describing a chair over two pages. You know, people do that because they get the word count up, so they describe a chair or a carpet or whatever, and no one cares. So I go through all those things. Because I've done it, you see, I'm able to talk to them in a way that I know works, but I do say everyone, and the timing, writing, everyone is different, and you've got to decide how you're going to do it. Some people don't have a computer. Some people write it longhand. Well, to keep editing longhand is very difficult, but a gentleman you've probably heard of called John le Carré.
Yeah.
Very famous. He's dead now. He lived quite near us. Well, I met him a few years ago now, and I said, how do you edit your books? He said, well, I don't edit them. I write longhand on paper. I said, oh, right. How do you do it? He said, well, I've got two tools. I said, right. He said, have a pair of scissors and a stapler. So what I do is I cut the pages up and staple it together and then give it to my wife to type. And then I'll read it and then edit it.
Oh, my gosh. That's a method I've never heard of. It may be uniquely John le Carré.
Yeah, and I always say carry a notebook. I've got notebooks everywhere, but don't rack it right on the back of the page because you might want to rip the page out. And if you've written on the back of that page may not be relevant to the front, or you may miss it. I always keep your notebooks, put a line through it when you've typed it up. Because I have notes, I've got five books of notes here for my new book. Tiny little bits, the odd word, the odd line, the odd situation. And I've got it, and I'm dreading getting into the book because I'm not sure where it's going to go yet. And I say, if there's anything you want to find out or you want to research, write that in the back of the book so you don't lose it. So whatever it may be. And then I also go to the tourist offices, wherever I'm writing about, and I ask them to send me a map, and I ask them to point out things that are of interest. Or I will go to those places and search it out, and I'll walk the streets where my characters are going to go to see what situations could come up. You know, it might be a crossroad, and there aren't any lights, so they've got to cross that road. So that's quite an important thing to put in the book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. Graham, this is such a it's always, always an absolute delight to talk with you. And it's always a delight and a thrill to grab hold of one of your books and just take off on an adventure. Thank you so much for your music that you know, to me, people who do what you do have your talent, musician, a writer, all the things that you speak about. You are the most generous people because you share these wonderful things you do with the rest of us. And thanks to modern technology, more of us have a chance to read you, listen to interviews, and get to know you. I will be sharing GrahamSlater.com and all of your links to all of your work on all of my social media, and I am so grateful. I wish you so much success, even continued success with what you do, and hope to get to meet you on one of these cruises one day, and wish the best to you.
It would be nice, wouldn't it? Yeah, it'd be great. Trouble is, we wouldn't stop talking, would we?
Oh, yeah. Well, if I was smart, I would do less talking and more listening so I could really learn from you. So thank you so much, everybody. The new book is, tell them, Graham.
Born to Run by Graham Slater with a C, C-L-A-T-E-R.
That's right, Born to Run. I'm going to run and get this book. And thank you so much. I think I'm going to go out, instead of with my song, I'm going to go out with our mutual friends, Jill Simes and Loving Kind, and A Place to Call Our Own. Graham, thanks. Hurry back. We love you, and all the best.